Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When you mention the name Bill Bartman in Tulsa, one thing you won't get is a neutral reaction. There are people who hate him and love him. Bartman has made and lost several fortunes in his life, and of course is best known for creating Consumer Financial Services, a debt collection company that treated their debtors with respect and resetting terms so that the debtors could actually repay more of their debt. And the company was spectacularly successful, growing at an incredible rate. But eventually, it imploded amidst charges of fraudulent stock transactions and debt sales. Bartman was eventually charged with 57 federal felony counts, but was acquitted on every charge, although he was forced into personal bankruptcy. Years later, a federal bankruptcy trustee would later admit there was no fraud to be found at CFS. After a few years, Bartman got back into the debt collection business with CFS2, which continues with the approach CFS started but expanded to include employment assistance, resume assistance, medical discounts, and help in accessing governmental assistance. But Bartman has gone even farther, pushing an initiative that would put most debt collectors out of business and transform the sleazier aspects of the business. He'll share his ideas with us today. He's also written his autobiography. It's titled Bouncing Back. Bill Bartman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Richard, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I want to talk a little bit about CFS2. Now, you're a well-known name in this city and probably respected in some, vilified in others because of your association with
sure.
CFS. Of course, you were vindicated of criminal charges, and that's all behind you. But you went right back into the same business with CFS2. How did that come about?
Well, it wasn't an easy decision to make. CFS, the original company, was a 13-year-old enterprise with 4,000 employees and a great history of really helping lots and lots of Americans get out of debt. And we loved that part, and it was wonderful. When the end came, and we'll talk about the end as little as much as you like, it was pretty ugly. And it's kind of like going through a bad divorce. You don't want to get remarried right away. So I took 10 years off, which is a long time. But my heart has always been in the same place. I think we all have been given some unique talents, gifts, and we should use what it is we've been given. The one talent, skill, or gift, or experience that I have, without sounding egotistical or immodest, is I really understand people in debt. I get that. I grew up in that. I've lived in that. As a lawyer, I worked in that arena. With CFS for 13 years, we dealt with 4.5 million Americans and got all of them out of debt without ever litigating one time against any of them. And so when I woke up after my bad divorce from CFS, I really knew there's only one thing I was really good at and should do. And so I recreated the same company in the same building. I just put a numeral two behind the name, because I am still proud of what we did the first time, how we did it, how we worked with our employees, and how we changed an ugly industry.
In your book, Bouncing Back, you detail your whole story and what happened at the end of CFS. And if you believe the prosecutors, it was you were so devious that not only were you able to commit a massive fraud, but you were able to cover the tracks well before the fraud was discovered. But of course, you were exonerated at trial. To me, it read as though this was a business that grew way too fast, too quick, and you went from being a small business to a very big business very quickly, and like a lot of businesses, you were a person that had control, and when it got too big for one person to control, things happened.
Yeah, and to both of those points, yes, if you listen to the prosecutor at the time of the allegations, you would think, I was so smart. I was like Miss Cleo of Tulsa. I could predict in advance what it is they were going to go do, and I built the perfect defense in anticipation of what it is they might do 3, 5, or 10 years later. Nobody is that smart, and so I think they gave me credit where credit really wasn't due. To the thing about CFS growing too fast, and maybe that was part of the problem, as much as I don't ever want to admit that because that would be a defect, the truth is you're right. I had grown other businesses previously. That wasn't my first business experience. But my previous biggest single company was 70 employees. And I like to think I did a good job and ran it well and made money and did all the right things. All of a sudden, we went from a relatively modest-sized CFS to 4,000 employees. I can tell you that was over my pay grade. In fact, so much so that I hired a president to come in and run the company. Now, the sad part of that is he only lasted 90 days and we found out it was like oil and water, you know, that our culture was different, Rich. We wanted to do things for our employees. You know, we had a high-stress environment where we really expected a lot out of our employees, kind of like the Marine Corps of debt-collecting companies. We wanted people who could work hard and do a good job. Now, in return for that, we gave them twice the industry standard wages. We had a free on-site daycare for 600 kids every single day. And we had 1,200 kids in our summer camp program, all of this free. We had a free medical program. We covered everything all the time. No exceptions, no deductions, no nothing. We paid for it all.
It's kind of like Google before Google, really, ways. But you expected your employees to
indeed.
Be it
and so when people
call.
Say, well, boy, it was a hard, stressed job, we say it was. Because when I speak to new employees every Friday, and I'd met with every new hire group, I would say this would be the best job you've ever had, and it's also going to be the hardest job you've ever had. Because we would take 1,000 applicants to find 100 that we thought were meritorious, and from that we'd get down to about 15 or 20 that we actually hired. And that's a pretty good culling process, because when you not only have these great perks and benefits, we had a 250% 401k match program, which is unbelievable. And then better than that, maybe, every year we took all of our employees on vacation. We just give them a vacation. So one year we rented 27 747s, and we flew 6,000 people to Disney World. Now, that's crazy for a for-profit company to do that for its employees. Now, in return, however, we said, we really want you 8 hours a day. We really want you paying attention. We really want you at it. And what we want you doing is helping people. You know, it isn't about how much money you make. It's about how many people can you really help. And I know that, again, that sounds contrary to most debt collection business philosophies, but our philosophy was, if you help people get out of the hole they're in, they will have more capacity later with which to pay you.
Now, did that always work out with the first company, or did CFS at time revert to a lot of other debt collectors where it's harassment? And
we never let ourselves revert, and we had a zero tolerance policy. So if any employee, and that's why some thought it sounds stressful, if they ever raised their voice, if they ever used profanity, if they ever did those things that you all, everybody knows are wrong to do, we fired on the first incident. Now, the reason we did that and could do that and felt morally okay with that is we had a 7-week training program in advance of putting that employee out on the floor. So our theory was, during the training program, we're giving them a first chance, second chance, third chance, fifth chance, 10th chance. And by the time they get through 7 weeks of training, if they're still making that mistake, that's intolerable. And for us, our attitude was, not everybody's going to pay us. Now, we know that. I can tell you, after having done this now with 4.5 million people, which is, by the way, is a pretty good petri dish to look down on, about 10% of the people on the face of the planet Earth will take advantage of you. They will hurt you. They will make your nose bleed. They will lie, cheat, and steal. And I hate to say those words, but they will. But remember I said it's 10%. The other 90%, they won't. The other 90% will work with you. They will do everything in their power to do what they can do. Now, they can't do very much because of where they're at economically. But we learn if you help them get out of the hole, then they will do as much as they possibly can, which means they would actually pay us more money by being nice to them than they would pay us if we yelled and screamed and demanded their money immediately. But 10% would never pay. And so what we did is we just cut them out of the herd. Rather than reverting to make a business model that dealt with the 10% and the 90% suffered, we said, no, we're going to do exactly the opposite. We're going to build a business model on the 90% and forget the 10%. And you would say, well, you're going to let them get away with it? You're going to let them get off? You're going to let them walk free? And the answer is, yeah.
They either pay or they don't. Anyway, so how CFS 2 turned out to be different than CFS?
CFS 1 was all about treating people with dignity and respect and not litigating, never suing a customer, which for debt collections is standard operating procedure. Yell and scream. If they don't pay, you sue them. Mm-hmm. I'm a lawyer by training and education, but my theory was, Rich, that's stupid. You're suing somebody to save me money? All you're doing is convincing them your dog is bigger than their dog. That doesn't make any money move. So our theory was, let's have to be nice. So that was CFS 1. At CFS 2, I remember I had a 10-year vacation. So I was able to look back at everything we did, and I thought, we didn't do something we should have done. We should have helped more, not just be nice. Being nice is wonderful. And compared to the other guys, wow, it's really different. But we said, what more could we do? So I went to my employees at CFS2 and said, how do we get our customers to love us? Now, I'll bet you, No owner of a debt collection company has ever asked his employees, how do we get our customers, remember I call them customers, not debtors, right. How do we get our customers to love us? Because it's a shocking statement, but my theory was, if we could identify that, we would have them. Well, they would trust us. They would respect us. They would listen to us. They would talk to us, because nobody will pay if you aren't even talking. And so my employees came to me and they said, the thing we ought to do is we ought to help them get out of their other debt. And I said, well, wait a minute. What do you mean, get them out of their other debt? We only own one, and they might have five other credit cards that we have no connectivity to. You know, we can't speak for the other four companies. And they said, well, why don't we just represent them as their attorney? With a power of attorney, we'll call up the other creditors and be their spokesperson. We'll represent our customer as against other creditors. We will negotiate with these other creditors. We'll get the other creditors to reduce their obligation, deservedly, because the customer doesn't have any money. And we'll help the customer find some money to extinguish the other creditors at a discount while not getting paid ourselves. We'll wait to be last. And I think you say, whoa, that's a stupid business model. No, deferred gratification works if it shows up. It's only when deferred gratification doesn't show up that you feel like an idiot.
Right.
Well, in our case, if you can get twice as much by being patient and helping, that's good business. That's good economics. So we did that, and it worked wonderfully and still works wonderfully.
And really, from what I understand, CFS2 is you're almost like a credit counseling agency.
Yeah. Well, then we went further, because my employees are really, remember this tired, charging, demanding thing? I got some really smart people, and they came and they said, Bill, what we're doing is great, but we need to do more. And I said, well, what more do you want to do? They said, let's get them jobs. The reason they're not paying us is mostly they have an employment issue. They're not making as much money as they used to make, or maybe they're not making any money. And I replied, we can't do that. We don't know how to get people jobs. We don't know any more about that than in the man on the moon. And they said, yeah, but we can learn. So today we have now helped 10,000 people across all 50 states, because we do this nationally, get a job where they get back on their feet, they earn a living, they feed their family. Oh, and by the way, we're not totally altruistic. Remember, if they have more money, they can pay us. And then I thought, oh, this is really great. We're helping them get out of debt. We're helping them get a job. And then my employees came back to me the third time. And by the way, we only do these three things now, but I know they're going to come back with a fourth thing. I just don't know what it is yet. But the third thing, they said, our customers need some help right now. You know, getting them out of debt is down the road, because it takes a while to do that. Getting them a job sometimes can take a while, too. They need food stamps. They need Medicaid. They need Medicare. They need Social Security. They need a wheelchair. They need a leaky roof fix. They need a hot water heater. They need things in their life today. And I said, come on, that's stupid. We can't do that. We're a debt collection company. That's crazy. And they said, no, it's not. Let's go find charitable organizations around the United States that actually do those things, because we know who the customer is who needs those things. Let's match and marry. Let's do like dating.com. You know, let's connect two parties who want what the other party has but don't know who the other party is, which is brilliant on my part for having employees smart enough to figure that out. You know, so I didn't contribute much. You know, I'm the guy that kept telling them they couldn't do it, that it wouldn't work. And they kept telling me, no, Bill, just shut up and sit down and we'll show you how it works. We now do that too, Rich. And we've moved to one that is my idea, and I will take credit for this one because they've got all the good stuff. I got what's left over. Financial literacy and budgeting is crucial to America. Right now, we as a country are really bad at it. We're bad at it in our schools. We're bad at it with the millennials who have graduated and can't add on their fingers, let alone a checkbook or a credit card or understand basic automobile finance or any of the stuff. And quite frankly, we're bad at it with adults. We've gone now for two or three generations of the whole financial world has moved really, really fast.
Well, it's all about deferred gratification is out of the equation. It's about getting a loan or using a credit card and getting that whatever it is now.
And so we made it part and parcel of our program. So now if you were my customer, I would say, Rich, I can help you. I can help you with your other debts. I can help you with a job. I can help you with some social services. But Rich, I need you to do something with me. I need you to sign up with me. And I'll do it for nothing, by the way. But I need you to take some budgeting classes. And I need you to take some financial literacy classes. Because I'm going to get you out of debt. That's my mission. I want to keep you out of debt. Because if I get you out of debt today and you don't know any more than you knew when you got a debt the first time, guess what's going to happen when I see you 6 months from now? You're going to be right back exactly in that same hole.
Now, Is this still a profit company at this point?
Is it profitable? Yes. Is it a for-profit company? Yes, it is. I could have done this as a not-for-profit just as easily.
Well, this is, we're going to talk about your proposal in a moment, which is geared towards nonprofit agencies.
Yeah. I do have a not-for-profit that I also run that does some of these services for, and we created it when the storms came through Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So for Moore, Oklahoma, and Shawnee, and El Reno, we had good citizens who had always paid their bills. They weren't the normal debtor as we think of them, you know, delinquent on their bills. They were Joe Sixpack. They were the guy that went to work every day and did their job and had a house and a family and kids. And then one day they came home and their house was gone. And they maybe didn't even have a mailbox for the bills to come into. But they now took all of their expendable reserve to build a new house, to buy a new refrigerator, to buy a new stove, to do buy groceries, buy new clothing, all those things that you and I take for granted every day. We go to the closet and get a shirt on in the morning. We go to the refrigerator and get our next meal. They had to go out and spend all of the reserve for all this stuff. Guess what didn't get done? They didn't pay their bills because they had two choices.
Well, and most of the time when you're replacing that, if you don't have ready cash, you're taking out a government disaster loan.
Yeah, and our government sometimes doesn't move as fast as disasters do. So we have that not-for-profit, and we do those kind of things. We helped about 400,000 employees of the government when the furloughs went through, when the government got shut down last fall.
Now, we don't. And that's done as a nonprofit.
Yes.
Now, as far as CFS2 is going, are you continuing to grow that business, or are you going to keep limits on the size of the business, or what exactly? Because, you know, as we talked about earlier, this was a, you know, CFS grew out of control, basically.
Yeah. Well, you know, you learn from your mistakes. At least I hope I do. Fortunately for me, as I've made so many, I must be a really smart guy by now. You know, when you CFS, when it crashed, it cost me a fortune. They estimate that it was worth $3.5 billion, which is really an awful lot of money. So when I tell people that I've got this really, really great education out of what happened, it's because I paid a really high tuition. I paid a $3.5 billion tuition. So let me tell you, Rich, I did learn some things. I learned that I'm really good at starting companies. I learned that I'm a really good entrepreneur at getting them going. I learned I'm not a good manager. I'm not the guy that I'll run a company when it starts getting to size. So are we going to grow CFS2? You betcha we are. But it won't be with me in that chair. It'll be me in the chairman's chair thinking up the next great idea, you know, hoping to go do something crazy, wonderful, that helps people in a way that nobody's ever thought of before. But day-to-day running a company, no, I found out that's just not my skill set.
My guest today is Bill Bartman, who's the CEO of CFS2. Of course, he's a very familiar name to Tulsans and invites diverse reactions. I guess that's probably the best way to put it.
Well, the way I would describe that, Rich, is that, you know, the population of Tulsa is divided into two camps, those who love me and those who don't. And it's probably about an equal number in each. And sadly, there's nobody in the middle.
It seems like you tell the story fairly honestly of what happened. But I want to talk about something that you vigorously always defended during CFS's fall. And, you know, this happened at the same time as Enron. This happened at the same time as several other unsustainable businesses, basically, that were living off of sophisticated financial transactions that sort of hid the true balance books.
Enron would be a classic example.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, what CFS was called was a Ponzi scheme. Why was CFS never a Ponzi scheme in your mind?
Well, it was so much never a Ponzi scheme that when the trial started, Judge Sven Holmes, sitting in the federal district court here in Tulsa, the prosecutors made that as one of their early motions. They wanted to describe the allegations that they were going to try to prove as a Ponzi scheme. And Judge Holmes just said, baloney. He said, a Ponzi scheme is predicated on you're using the next guy's money for the last guy's obligation. You keep rolling forward. It's the old wimpy hamburger thing. I'll gladly pay you Tuesday. We weren't doing that. That was not part of the element. We were buying loans, collecting them, buying more loans, collecting them, buying more loans, and collecting them. And they never had one to do with the other. Well, Judge Holmes saw through that immediately and said, no, that all you're doing is creating an inflammatory word that's going to hopefully, in your mind, bias the jury against it. So they couldn't use that term.
My guest today is Bill Bartman. He's the author of a new book, his autobiography, Bouncing Back. He also has an interesting idea for the credit industry. And you've been talking this and talking to people in Washington, and it's basically a tax credit to incentivize banks to donate their delinquent credit card loans to charitable organizations. Now, what is behind this idea?
For the last 3+ years, I have been crusading against debt collectors, because although I am one, I think the industry is notorious for doing it wrong, doing it badly, yelling and screaming, swearing, suing people, things I just don't agree to, and say, I didn't do for 16 years. You know, we have a great track record of practicing what it is we preach, so it isn't about me. But it is about, I have proven empirically their model doesn't work. Yelling and screaming and suing people does not produce the same economic outcome as does treating people nicely and gingerly and helpfully. So I know that. And when I learned that, I said, okay, then how do I make the industry do it my way? And the answer came back after I went through attorney generals. I visited all 54, believe it or not, there really are 54 attorney generals. No, it's not bad math. You count the territories in Guam and Puerto Rico and et cetera. I have visited now with every single attorney general in every single state and territory about the abuses. I've written white papers. I've written a book on debt collection abuses. I have been on as many national TV and other programs as I can, not for ego trip, but to talk about what's wrong and what they ought to do. I've met with Congress. I've met with Rich Cordray at the CFPB. I've met with charitable organizations around the country to try to convince them there was a better way of doing this, and mostly I didn't get very far. Mostly I got lip service. Mostly I got people saying, oh, yeah, that's a problem, and then would turn around and walk away, or at least they wouldn't put their shoulder to the wheel. And I thought, most people don't do something unless there's something in it for them or they can get some value or benefit out of it. And I thought, man, I'm never going to convince that audience that they should change the laws and the regulations and the rules to make debt collecting more honorably. So I said, then why don't I just do away with the whole industry? Why don't you wipe out debt collectors? Now, the way to do that is the banks, and they are the preponderant. Last year, banks in the United States sold $68 billion worth of delinquent loans to debt collectors, who then went out and rape, pillaged, and burned 35 million families to squeeze blood out of a turnip. So trying to stop 4,500 debt collection companies from doing that again tomorrow, I said, well, I can do it one of two ways. I can try to make them get religion and learn better, or I just turn off the oxygen. If you cut off the inventory to the people who are doing it badly, they have no more inventory with which to do it badly. So I thought, eureka. It's kind of like the old thing of, why mop up the floor without turning off the faucet? I want to turn off the faucet. So my theory was, if I don't want the bad debt collectors to get all this inventory, delinquent debt, to collect, somebody's got to do it. How can we do it? I thought, well, who could do it well? Who could do it right? Who could do it the way I think it ought to be done, nicely? Well, 501c3s. They're already helping people. They're already mostly in the same arena. Anyhow, the customer I have for a debt, John 3:16 has, or Salvation Army has, or Catholic Charities has, or Community Action Project has. Why don't we train those organizations with the right mindset to do this thing we call debt collection? Only they wouldn't do debt collection, they'd do debt restructuring. They would help their customer by saying, Rich, you owe $10,000. You don't have much money. You can't pay $10,000. Could you pay $2,000? Yes. Good. Let me rewrite your $10,000 note to a $2,000 note and make it a $100 a month payment instead of a $500 a month payment. Guess what would happen to you, Rich? You'd get back on track. Your FICO score would start improving. You'd feel like a good, honest citizen again. You'd feel like a person.
Now, the hard part is getting the banks to give that debt to 501c3s. How do you get the banks to do that? Because even though it may be an uncollectible debt for the bank, they'll still be able to sell it for 5 cents, 10 cents, 20 cents, 25 cents on the dollar to a loan collection agency.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm a very pragmatic guy, and I am convinced that banks will not do the right thing for the right reason, but they will do the right thing for the wrong reason. So you have
to get a return.
Yes. Banks are in it to make money. That's pretty novel. So let's show them a way they can make money and accomplish what it is we really want to accomplish. Remember, what we really want to accomplish is we have 35 million families right now being chased by third-party debt collectors. And those families are running into all kinds of issues and problems. We know, everybody who has an IQ above room temperature knows, that financial strain is the number one cause for divorce. Financial strain is the number one cause for sexual abuse, spousal abuse, and child abuse. We know that financial strain on a family is what tears it apart, and we know that financial strain on families creates financial strain on children. When children are in that environment, they are less likely to stay in school. They are more likely to follow in the footsteps of their parents, committing those very same abuses. We see youngsters, teenagers, even pre-teenagers, making bad decisions that lead to children having children. All of it going back to one source. If we could just take the financial stress off the family, maybe some of that would go away. Not all of it in every day, and it's not a perfect panacea, but God, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could cut all that stuff in half?
Okay, now, one of the things you mentioned is that you think that offering a tax credit to banks would entice them to donate this credit, and that you could cut personal bankruptcies by about 50%.
Yes.
Where does that number come from?
Yeah, we did a study last year of 3,082 individuals who filed bankruptcy. And we did something that no one else has ever done in that arena. We also had access to their credit report. We had access to their bankruptcy matrix. And we had access to all of their other personal information. So we could not only do survey questions and ask them, why did you do what you did? We also had this extrinsic data to validate what it is they were saying. And we conclusively proved that 72% of the people who filed bankruptcy in America last year filed bankruptcy not because of the volume of their debt, which is what everybody thinks. What mattered is whether or not they, as an individual, had been sued by a creditor. Because even if you have a lot of debt and nobody's doing anything about it, you don't care. If you have a lot of debt and they're just yelling but not yelling too loud, you don't care. But when they sue you, the game is over.
They're garnishing wages, they're putting liens on houses and everything like that.
Yeah. Yes. And so we looked at that and said, then we know if we could convince banks to do this for the right thing for the wrong reason, give them a tax credit, and I hate that because it's a bad taste in my mouth to give banks a tax credit because you're saying, aren't you rewarding the banks for doing something that...
Making bad loans, for one.
Indeed, or not being very responsible in their lending, for two. It's like taking castor oil. First it makes you worse, and then it makes you better. And so if we have to give them something to accomplish a greater societal good, where we get 35 million people out of a hole, where we could cut the bankruptcy rate by 50%, something 75%, where we could get the unemployment rate to drop by one full point, something by two, where we could stop 10 million lawsuits in America every year, unclogging court systems in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and across the entire United States, where your taxes, my taxes, and every other citizen's taxes is paying for debt collectors to use our courthouses to collect their money, to put our citizens in a bad place, that's wrong. So if you want to talk about some reward going to banks who aren't deserving, we've been rewarding debt collectors for the last 30 years, letting them use our machinery called a judicial system to enforce their debt that they bought for a nickel or a dime, and now they're getting a judgment for 100 cents on the dollar, and they're squeezing the life out of a family. Well, when we see all those things, we say, if we have to give the bank a tax credit, that's the least of our worries. Let's get these 35 million families back on their feet again. It would produce $47 billion in debt forgiveness, principal reduction to the people in this country who need it the most. And guess what those people will do? They will respend some of that money next when this liability goes away. And you say, well, gee, Bill, they're going to get right back on the same problem. No, with financial literacy and some budgeting skills, they may not. But if they actually went out and spent $47 billion again, guess what happened to this economy? No, we would finally get this darn thing moving.
All right. Well, it sounds like a really interesting idea. Bill Bartman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Bill Bartman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the CEO of CFS2 and the author of Bouncing Back, his autobiography. It's published by Brown Books Publishing. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.